Brilliant, Paul. Thanks for reading. I think this is quite a technical passage. I found it quite hard to get my head around, but I've also found it quite heartwarming as I've prepared it. So I hope some of that will come over. I mean, if we start off, just imagine, if you can, a world where kindness is not taken advantage of, where you can love without having it thrown back in your face, a world where the strong nurture the weak, where violence gives way to listening, where you can trust what people say, a world where you could leave your bike up unchained overnight and it'll still be there in the morning, a world where a woman can walk home late at night without fear. In other words, imagine a world with the best of humanity and none of the sin that so easily spoils things. I guess it's a world that we would all long for, right? We would all long to be in that kind of a place. And it's really what Jesus describes as he speaks about the kingdom of heaven, a world without any violence or selfishness or hatred, but just love and restraint and pure worship. But the question becomes, if we've got that kind of vision of a world, how do we get there? And this is where people begin to disagree with each other, because some will say, well, to get to that kind of world, you need rules. You need a framework, you need to educate people, you need values. Anything else is lawlessness. Other people would say, actually, if we're going to get there, laws are the problem. You've just got to set people free to be true to themselves. They'll say anything else is cold legalism. So those are the kind of the two things you get, a tension between the accusation of lawlessness and the accusation of legalism. And of course, those are the exact two accusations that Jesus had thrown at him in his lifetime. So some people say, well, Christians, you're legalists, you're cold, finger-wagging people. Other people will say, well, Christians, you're lawless. You believe that God forgives. And so you've got no real incentive to try and live a good life. What we see Jesus do in these verses is he lays out his path for righteousness. But as he does so, he is neither a cold legalist nor lawless. Not because he drives a path between the middle, but actually what he says is the law completely matters, but it's nothing cold. What he gives us is a righteousness that's really worth pursuing, and I think that's where the warmth of this passage comes in. What I want to do is give us two thoughts on the path to righteousness that Jesus lays out, one thinking about legalism, one thinking about lawlessness, and then just a couple of examples to try and put some flesh on the bones. So firstly then, Jesus talks here about a righteousness fulfilled, and this is verse 17. Don't think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. It seems that in Jesus' day, he was accused of being lawless. He challenged the scribes. He upturned their understanding of the Sabbath. He taught a gospel of forgiveness. And people said, you're undermining the very fabric of society. You're lawless. And of course, that's an accusation that echoes through the centuries, isn't it? Paul in Romans, shall we carry on sinning that grace may abound? Or there was a German poet who famously on his deathbed said, God will forgive, that's his job. Or today you'll see it in the Christian in the workplace who just doesn't really seem to have any issue with behaving in a way that's outrageous and is quick to claim God's forgiveness rather than to mourn their sin. How does a doctrine of forgiveness fit with righteousness? Well, verse 17, Jesus says, I've not come to abolish the law. That word for abolish is the word that you would use for taking a sledgehammer to a building. People are saying you're taking a sledgehammer to our core values. And Jesus says, no, far from it. In fact, verse 18, I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not even an iota or a dot will pass from the law. He's come to fulfill the law and the prophets. Now, I think for many of us, that's slightly disappointing because we probably don't view law in a very warm way. We view it as being slightly cold. We see the prophets as being slightly confusing. We think authority is open to abuse. We're not very excited when Jesus says, I haven't come to abolish the law and the prophets. Let's just try and get ourselves into the mindset of Jesus first here. What did the law represent to them? Well, it was the very foundation of society. It was where they got their values from. It was what defined what was right and wrong. It was where they sought wisdom. It was where they met with God. It was where they encountered his glory. In other words, law for them was not a cold authority. It was a wonderful thing. Okay, here's a slightly simplistic way to think about it. Imagine that I pick up my Jamie Oliver's cookbook, Jamie's Italy, from my bookshelf, and this book contains laws and rules for me to follow. But I don't object to it because they're inviting me into the wonderful culinary world of Jamie's kitchen. In the same way, the Old Testament law was, if you like, an invitation to know God's glory. Or maybe a better illustration, imagine a friend invites us off to a friend of a friend who owns some massive big estate in the country. And we get a letter beforehand with directions on how to get there, instructions about what we might like to bring, maybe a couple of house rules, please bring some slippers because, you know, we like to keep the house nice. We wouldn't object to that. It's great, it's an invitation. One of the big questions that runs through the Old Testament is, how can God dwell with his people? It's an invitation. The Old Testament is an invitation to know God, to be his people, to find his blessings, to see his glory. And so when Jesus says, I've not come to abolish the law or the prophets, that's the context into which he says this. The law and the prophets led the people to God, and he's saying, I'm going to lead you deeper to God. Maybe one way to think about it is, if our society is cold towards the idea of law, I think we're quite positive about values, right? Everyone's workplace, you've got a mission statement and you've got core values, right? Even the people who make my ice cream have their core values. I'd rather just make the pots bigger, but there you go. We're all talking about values all the time. Well, Jesus essentially says here, I've not come to undermine your core values, what you care about, what defines you, what shapes you. So Jesus is no anarchist. He is not lawless. He says, you care about what's right and wrong? So do I. You care about how you're treated, how other people treat you, how you treat others? So do I. Yes, Jesus teaches a gospel of forgiveness, but it's not cheap grace. Our actions have dignity, they have meaning. Maybe we're here this lunchtime and we've fallen for that idea of cheap grace, that how we behave doesn't matter to God. Well, Jesus says it does. He's upholding the values of the Old Testament. They stand today. So here's a righteousness worth pursuing. But I think it goes slightly deeper than just a righteousness of the Old Testament, because notice particularly this word fulfill in verse 17. Don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Over half term, I found myself when I was away with my son on an archery range, sort of shooting arrows at the archery targets. Don't know what we were doing there. Anyway, as you shoot the arrow, it's quite satisfying. You know, you watch it go through the air, you can track its arc with your eye, and then bang, it thuds into the target. Actually, some of mine went over, but ideally it thuds into the target. Well, what Jesus is saying, the whole arc of the Old Testament, it's heading towards him. Here's the direction in which it all points. So he's not just saying that he keeps the Old Testament law. He does. He's the most righteous man who ever lived. But it's not just that he keeps it, he fulfills it. It's as if the Old Testament law were like a pencil outline that he's come to colour in for us. Nor is he just saying that he teaches about the law. He does, we'll see that in a minute. But he's not just giving us principles. Sometimes people say, well, Jesus taught that love was the greatest commandment, and therefore we view the Old Testament through the lens of love. It's not quite right. We view the Old Testament through the lens of Jesus, who taught about love. And so he's, if you like, the one for whom the law has been waiting to come and open up its full treasures. He's that ark of flight. And that means that it's not just part of the Old Testament law that he fulfills. Verse 18, I tell you, until the heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law. Jesus fulfills the law in different ways. The laws of the Old Testament sacrificial system, well, they're fulfilled in Jesus' death on the cross. That's why we don't offer sacrifices in the temple anymore. Later on in this chapter, we'll see Jesus intensifying the law. He'll fulfill it in different ways, but all of it points forward to Jesus. Now, here's a question. Why does this matter? Well, at one level, because Jesus is not an anarchist, he's not lawless. But at another level, it begins to broaden our view of who Jesus is. As we read the Old Testament, there's some of the most profound wisdom in here that has shaped civilizations, including our own, throughout the centuries. As I read the Old Testament, if I sense something of God's wisdom and I long to know it better, well, I'll find that fulfilled in Jesus. If I sense something of God's compassion, I'll see that fulfilled in Jesus' death on the cross. If I sense something of God's power, I'll see it fulfilled as Jesus is raised from the dead. If I sense something of God's glory, his smoke filling the temple, I'll see that ultimately fulfilled as Jesus is raised from the dead. If I see in the Old Testament this tension of how can a holy God live with a sinful people, I see that fulfilled as Jesus dies in my place for my sin on the cross. It's a righteousness fulfilled. So, Jesus is not lawless. he's upholding the Old Testament. But the question then becomes, is he just another cold legalist? Well, secondly, we see here a righteousness surpassed. And this is verse 20. Jesus says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." And that is a massive shock for the people of Jesus' day. Because the Pharisees, they were fastidious about keeping the law. They really kept it in detail. Here's how fastidious they were. If they grew herbs in their garden, the law told them they had to give a tenth of everything they earned to God. So they would give a tenth of their herbs. So if they grew some dill in their garden, they'd take off a tenth of their dill to the temple and give it to God. I mean, that's attention to detail, right? You couldn't get much harder than that. It's kind of exhausting. And what does Jesus say? Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. In fact, in verse 48, what he's going to say is that we need to be perfect. So this is a righteousness that is greater, that surpasses the Pharisees. And what happens in the rest of this chapter is that Jesus takes a whole load of rules. Don't commit adultery, don't murder. Things that the Pharisees could very easily keep. And then he shows them how they've got too small an understanding of the law. They've domesticated God. They've made his demands less demanding. They've made his permissions more permissive. They've read God's law, but they've missed his heart. So when the Pharisees read through the law, they came up with 248 commands and 365 prohibitions. But they didn't find the heart of God, and they didn't long to please him. They were a bit like someone like going to see Van Gogh's sunflowers and sitting there counting the petals, but not registering that this is a wonderful work of art. They seemed to be willing to please God, but they weren't pursuing his heart. I want you to know that I'm not watching Strictly Come Dancing. It's just not my thing. I want to be utterly clear about that. But I know enough about ballroom dancing to know that you can teach someone where to put their feet. It doesn't mean that they're dancing. The Pharisees could put their feet in the right place, but there was no soul, there was no heart that sought after God. And I think we all hate that, don't we? That kind of cold, mechanical obedience that cares more for our appearances than for reality, that can spot error a mile off, that boasts about how righteous we are, but it's kind of forgot why we're in this in the first place. That's the fruit of legalistic righteousness. And what it bears is it brings forth fear, because I'm worried about getting things wrong. It brings forth pride, because if I've made righteousness a ladder that I climb up to God, I've got to prove that I've climbed higher than anyone else. And it makes me frustrated, because of course I can't live up to God's standards, I can't be perfect. And so actually, I end up giving way to hypocrisy. Maybe we're here this lunchtime and we've drifted into it. Perhaps we're Christian and we've drifted into cold judgmentalism. Perhaps we're looking into the faith and we've got our own ideas of what is right and wrong. We sit and watch everyone else with a clipboard. And Jesus is calling us to something far deeper. I mean, we'll see this everywhere, won't we? We'll see it in traditional institutions that only allow a certain type of person in it. And we'll see it in those who react against that. Tom Holland, the historian, likes to refer to woke liberalism as the new Puritanism, because it has a near religious fervour in insisting that people speak and behave in a certain way. Whatever our politics, we all drift into legalism. The question the legalist asks is, what does this look like, rather than, is this right? And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we all drift into that. And Jesus says, no, don't settle for that. I'm calling you to something far greater, a righteousness that surpasses that of the Pharisees, because it is of the heart. It's got depth to it. And isn't that a good thing? But the gospel is good news. Isn't it wonderful that Jesus calls us to this deeper righteousness, that he wants us to go deeper than those core values that are no doubt stuck on our office wall somewhere? He wants something greater than that. Not only that, but when he died on the cross, he died for our sin and he clothes us in his righteousness. He gives us his spirit to transform us, to write his law on our hearts, that one day we can enter his heaven perfected by the Lord Jesus. That's a righteousness surpassed. What I want to do quickly now is just give a couple of examples of this righteousness fulfilled, or if you like, deepened. So thirdly, a righteousness deepened. What happens in verses 21 to 47 is that Jesus just gives some examples. And what he does all the time is he takes the law deeper. sometimes going beyond the law, intensifying it, sometimes actually setting part of it aside to show us its true heart. A bit like someone taking, like a kid picking up a conker in the playground, and they peel back the green shell to show the heart of the conker at the heart of it. That's what he's doing. So two examples. Firstly is about inner rather than outer righteousness. Verse 27, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. He's going for the inner, the heart, and not just outer obedience. For the people of Jesus' day, adultery was essentially theft. They actually overlooked adultery if someone else's wife wasn't involved. But Jesus says, don't settle for that. We want much better than that. We want purity of thought, so much so that if your eye causes you to sin, you pluck it out. This is a deeper righteousness, right? This is far more attractive than what people fob us off with today. And you can see that it's not legalism. He's not just getting into definitions of have I ticked the box, but it's not lawless. He cares deeply about how we treat each other. It's a righteousness worth pursuing. The second example is about, he shows us how what we should care about is not what we can get away with, but what we're chasing after. And this is what he says about oaths. It's there in verse 33. You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you've sworn. But I tell you, don't take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it's his footstool, and so on. It seems that what was going on in Jesus' day was that people had all sorts of technicalities. So if you swore by the name of God, you had to keep your promise. If you swore by the name of heaven, you hadn't actually mentioned God's name, so you didn't need to keep your promise. And they'd build up all these technicalities. And Jesus says, look, let's just peel away all of that. What is the Old Testament saying? It's saying be truthful. So while the Old Testament does tell people about making oaths, Jesus says you don't need to do that. Just speak the truth. That is the deeper meaning of the law. What is he doing? It's not legalism. He's not plunging off into technicalities. But it's not lawless either, because he cares deeply about the truth. It's a righteousness that is worth pursuing. So look, where have we got to as we think about this topic of righteousness? I think this is quite an involved passage. What does it mean for Jesus to fulfill the law? It's quite complicated. But at the heart of it, I think what's going on is that Jesus is saying, look, I'm not giving you cold legalism that we so often get in our workplaces, nor am I giving you lawlessness. I care how you live, but with a passion of the heart. His righteousness, fulfilled in his teaching, his obedience, his events of life, it's just far more beautiful. It's far more praiseworthy. It's far more wonderful than what we're given today. And I hope that